Nightlife with Philip Clark
on ABC Radio.
Beethoven, the musical genius, died 196 years ago at the age of 56. As was tradition in the 19th century, Beethoven gave locks of hair to friends while he was alive, and several more were cut off when he died. Well, now, I guess you know where this is headed, a team of scientists have managed to get their hands on the hair and have sequenced Beethoven's genome. The study provides new clues about the health complaints that ailed him, as well as surprises in his family history. Joining us tonight, Belinda Smith from ABC Science. Belinda, good evening. Welcome back to Nightlife.
Thanks very much, Phil. Good to be back.
This is... isn't science fun sometimes? Why did they want to do this anyway? Oh, well, I suppose the answer's obvious, is it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, first of all, it's Beethoven. That's pretty cool in itself. But this is 200-year-old hair as well. And to sequence not his whole genome, maybe 23% of his genome, just from hair is quite a feat in itself, because any fans of CSI or any kind of forensic television show would know that the hair that grows out of your head, once it's past your scalp, doesn't have all that much in terms of like...
Yeah, I thought it didn't have anything much. It's just keratin or something, isn't it?
So the long strands of DNA that are sort of in the cells in, you know, the root of the hair, as they get pushed out, they get chopped up into smaller bits. And so there's DNA in there. It's just in fragments. So what this team of researchers did was they sequenced what bits they could find in these strands of hair and then matched them up with what's called a reference genome. It's kind of like the picture on the front of a jigsaw box. Mm-hmm. And using that reference genome, they kind of put together, I guess, bits of his genome, and that's how they found 2/3 of it, just for bits of,
and this,
bits
this
of
came
DNA
off,
in his hair.
This came off a thing called the stump lock, which was the best preserved of the... Well, there are 5 locks of hair apparently available, and this was the best one, was it?
Yeah, that's right. So there's a few tufts of hair getting around purporting to be from Beethoven's head. As you said, 5 of them seem to actually be from Beethoven. So another thing these researchers did was they sort of tested the veracity of these claims.
Yeah.
So 3 of the locks of the hair were not him. One of them was a woman. So, you know, you can really quite clearly...
Bad luck to the owners.
Right? Some of these locks of hair go for quite a lot of money at auction too. So you'd be a little annoyed. But when they sort of figured out that, yes, they have these locks of what, you know, they're pretty certain did come from Beethoven's head, then that's what they used then to reconstruct his genome. And as you alluded to, I mean, he had some health complaints when he was alive. Most famously, he started going deaf when he was in his 20s. And the researchers couldn't find any genetic variants that could be related to him losing his hearing. But they also looked for, and I didn't know this, but Beethoven had a horrible time in terms of gut health. So he suffered from debilitating bouts of vomiting and diarrhea for most of his life. And so these researchers went looking for gene variants related to things like Crohn's disease, but they couldn't find anything sort of related to what might have been causing his intestinal distress. Which is interesting. So this study ruled a lot of stuff out, didn't rule a whole lot in.
Yeah, that's disappointing, because I suppose the great story about Beethoven and his genius is this: how did he compose the music he did in the latter part of his life when he was pretty much deaf? I mean, in particular, you know, the Symphony Number 9, the glorious Symphony Number 9, composed when he was entirely deaf.
It's so astounding, right?
So there's no genetic evidence revealed here as to what might have caused that deafness.
Not that they could find in the genome that they managed to, you know, stitch together from his hair. What they did find, which is quite interesting, was he seemed to have a genetic predisposition to liver disease.
Oh, yeah.
So it's thought that perhaps he died of psoriasis. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know...
So he was on the cans the whole of his life, wasn't he?
He was on the cans. Plenty of cans. Plenty of flagons, I guess, back in those days.
Yes.
But he was quite a big drinker as well, which could have, you know, contributed to him, him and his liver disease. And, that is one thing that they could take from his genome, that he had this genetic variant which may have contributed to his... sick liver.
Okay. There was also a family surprise, apparently.
There was. So this is, you know, you read about people that get their genome sequenced with, you know, a company or something, and they find out that, oh, their father's not really their father, or, you know, they've got a mystery half-sibling somewhere out there. But, yeah, there's a little bit of that going on with Beethoven's lineage. Someone's father was not their biological father, and these researchers also managed to piece this together by looking at the genomes of people, of men with Van Beethoven as their surname today. And so they could trace their lineage through, you know, the family histories as well as the genes, but they didn't have the same Y chromosome as Beethoven.
The father wasn't the father.
There's a father in there that's not a father, somewhere in there. They don't know where, but as you know, lots of families are a little bit murky.
Is it that Beethoven's father was not his father, or
no, not necessarily. Somewhere along that line,
right?
Potentially, Beethoven's father, but it could have been elsewhere as well. They can't quite pinpoint exactly where, but they think somewhere between 1572 and 1700, there was a child in there, a male child whose father was not the father in the genealogy records.
Oh, okay. Mm. All right. But that's not Beethoven, though, himself.
That's not Beethoven. No. Could be his dad.
That's the one we're interested in, aren't they?
And
unfortunately, they've not yet isolated the gene for musical genius, have they?
They haven't. I can tell you I do not have that gene.
otherwise, genetic scientists might be really in the riches. Okay, interesting. Now, to the ocean shallows now, Belinda. New research has revealed the majority of shallow water reef species living around Australia's coastlines have declined in number over the last 10 years. What are we talking about here?
So these are, like you said, shallow water species. So these are species that tend to live in cooler waters. There are some warm water species as well that live in shallow areas. And some of these have actually expanded their range and increased in number. But, yeah, it seems like the cooler water species are on the decline. And this has kind of got, you can kind of see this as well on land, where alpine species of animals kind of get pushed up mountains as the climate warms. They have to keep to where it's cooler, so they keep going up mountains, so they get sort of condensed and pushed into these more concentrated areas. And we're seeing this now in the ocean. And what's quite striking about this story, the thing that struck me the most, I guess, was you can see these effects over the past decade, which is, you know, that was 2013. But to now, it's recent history that this is happening.
Yes, the populations like the weedy sea dragon declined by nearly 60%. Nearly 60%.
It is that, yeah, the weedy sea dragon, what a beautiful little creature, but also things like sea urchins and the like. And the researchers saw more of an effect around southern Australia, obviously where it's cooler. Sometimes you can get ocean heat waves, and I mean, it doesn't sound like much. The water goes up by 4 degrees, but in the ocean, that is huge amount of heat being pumped into a system which isn't normally getting it. So there's this current that sweeps down the West Australian coast and kind of curls around to the southern sort of ocean bit, and then across to Tasmania. And that heat wave happened, I think it was like 2011, and we're still not seeing species bouncing back after that heat wave.
Do we conclude that they're on a path to extinction?
Could be. Yeah, I mean, they'll definitely contract in number as their, I guess, their habitat that they can live in also contracts.
Yeah, it's depressing, isn't it?
There's not much good climate news at the moment, Phil.
No, exactly. All right, to let's go off-world and talk about the extraordinary dust storm that's been observed on a planet outside our solar system for the first time. I find it astonishing that they could look at anything outside the solar system. In fact, we can thank the James Webb Telescope, even though it's not working 100% well, but we can thank that for this. How could they see a dust storm on a planet anyway?
Yeah, no, this boggles my mind as well.
Yeah.
So this, in terms of
consider myself boggled. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, if you're not boggled by this, I want to know what shocks you. If your mind's not boggled by this. So yes, there's this planet. It's about 40 light years from Earth, so it's relatively close.
Mm-hmm.
And the James Webb Space Telescope looked at it, and what it did, it wasn't taking a photo of the exoplanet like we might take a photo of Jupiter, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
It was looking at the infrared radiation that this planet was shrugging off. So it's really hot, this exoplanet. It's called VHS 1256b. Let's just call it.
Of course it is.
The exoplanet. Of course it is, yes. But let's just call it the exoplanet. So it's shrugging off all this infrared heat because it's so hot.
Mm-hmm.
And the James Webb Space Telescope could see fluctuations in the brightness of this infrared light that was coming at it. It's light that we can't see, but it can pick up. And it could analyze that light. And the most likely explanation for this brightness and dimming is that it's kind of this roiling, dusty atmosphere where really, really fine silicate dust, like smoke particle fine,
mm-hmm.
wells up from somewhere inside the planet, wells up to the top of the atmosphere, and then drops back down again. So you get this sort of circulation happening in the atmosphere. And as it's doing that, it's kind of pulsing heat in different spots and glowing and not glowing and dimming and whatever. And so that's what the James Webb Space Telescope picked up. So it's like a dust storm, but not like a dust storm on Earth.
Quite something, isn't it? It's amazing.
Really. It is amazing. I mean, this is a big planet in our terms. So it's maybe 12 to 18 times the mass of Jupiter. Jupiter, of course, is the biggest planet in our solar system.
Mm.
And it's just, it's just this hot, turbulent kind of world,
which we will always have to look at from afar because we will never be able to go there. But still.
No, we won't.
Just before you go, this is great in beetle news, which we always try and keep across, of course.
Yes, of course.
Beetles could drink water through their mouths if they want, but they choose not to.
This is true. Have you ever thought about why some beetles can go their whole life without drinking water? Of course you have.
Of course I have. It occupies me night and day. That's right.
Well, luckily science has an answer for you. It turns out that some beetles, beetles that live in really dry environments like grain silos and the like, to drink water, they open their rectum, let the air in, and suck the moisture out of that air.
Hey.
And now scientists have figured out exactly how they do this.
Hang on. They just let air in and then they capture the water in the air. Wow.
That's right. Exactly.
They're like a sort of a heat exchanger. No, they're a vapor exchanger.
Yeah, exactly right. So they've got these special cells that sit. So, okay, let's talk a bit of beetle rectal anatomy.
Yeah,
so around their rectum, I guess, they've got these kidney cells that sit kind of like nestled up against the tube. And then they've got the circulatory system, their blood, I guess, on the other side.
Mm-hmm.
And sitting between the blood and the kidney cells are these special cells that pump salt into the kidney cells. And that salt, like osmosis, sucks the water across into the kidney cells, which then gets transported across into the blood. So that's the way they drink and absorb liquid in very, very dry environments.
How about that?
Yep.
The beautiful bum-sucking beetle.
Isn't nature wonderful?
Isn't nature wonderful, exactly. Thank you, Belinda.
You're welcome, Phil. Anytime.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.